Now, we have been looking yesterday at Chrysostom, and we noticed what a great preacher Chrysostom was, and what a tremendous influence he had with his very stirring sermon. I'm going to read two or three very brief extracts from his sermon, just to give a little idea of his rhetorical style. For instance, in his sermon on Matthew 31:42, he said, "The doctrine of the incarnation was very hard to receive. For consider what a great thing it was to hear and to learn that God, the ineffable, the incorruptible, the unintelligible, the invisible, the incomprehensible, in whose hands are the ends of the earth, who looks upon the earth and causes it to tremble, who touches the mountains and makes them smoke, the weight of whose condescension not even the cherubim were able to bear, but veiled their faces by the shelter of their wings, that this God, who surpasses all understandings and baffles all calculations, having passed by all angels, archangels, and all the spiritual powers above, deigned to become man and to take flesh formed of earth and clay, and suffer all things to which man is liable." Here's an extract from another sermon written right after a great crisis had occurred. "Delectable indeed are the meadow and the garden, but far more delectable the study of divine writing. For there indeed are flowers which fade, but here are thoughts which abide in full bloom. There is the breeze of the zephyr, but here is the breath of the spirit. There is the hedge of thorns, but here is the guarding providence of God. There is the song of the grasshoppers, but here is the melody of the prophet. There is the pleasure that comes from sight, but here is the profit that comes from study. The garden is confined to one place, but the scriptures are in all parts of the world. The garden is subject to the necessities of the season, but the scriptures are rich in foliage and laden with fruit alike in winter and summer. Let us then give diligent heed to the study of the scriptures, for if you do this, the scriptures will expel your despondency and engender pleasure. And in the tumult of life, it will save you from suffering like those who were tossed by troubled waves. The sea rages, but you sail on with calm weather, for you have the scripture for your pilot. A few days ago, the church was besieged. An army came, and fire issued from their eyes, yet it did not scorch the olive tree. Swords were unsheathed, yet no one received a wound. The imperial gates were in distress, but the church was in security." Now we notice how Chrysostom, after being carried to Constantinople against his will and made bishop there, he refused to simply be one who would tickle the ears of the people who had brought him and who were proud of having the greatest preacher in the Christian world to be an ornament for their city, but he lashed out against the sins and vices and luxuries of the capital, and how finally the wife of the emperor caused that he be sent into exile. And I'd just like to read a brief passage about the way they treated him as he was being sent into exile there. On July 4th, he started on his sad journey. Straight across Asia Minor, the road lay, through the primeval shadowy forest of Bithynia, across the salt deserts and burning trackless wastes of Galatia, through the wild mountain gorges of Cappadocia went this dismal pilgrim's progress, heart sore, foot weary, hopeless, sick, feeding on black bread, drinking foul water, scorched with fever, shaking with chills, watching by night against the prowling bandits, threatened each day by the bishop through whose diocese he must pass. No wonder the aged sufferer writes that his loss is worse, that his lot is worse than the chained convict who works in the public mine. He came to one area in Cappadocia where he had received a word from the bishop that a warm welcome would await him. And he says in his letter, "I found an impression in my mind precisely the reverse, but of this I said nothing." Now he says, "When I arrived late one evening at Caesarea in an exhausted and worn out condition," he was forced to walk a little distance with the soldiers guarding him and hurrying him on, "being in the very height of a burning fever, faint and suffering to the last degree, I lighted upon an inn situated just in the outskirts of the city and took great pains to find some physician and allay this fiery fever, for it was now at its height. And in addition, there was the fatigue of the journey, the toil, the strain, the total absence of attendance, the difficulty of getting supplies, the need of a physician, the wasting effects of toil and heat and sleeplessness. Thus, I was well nigh a dead man when I entered the city. Then, indeed, I was visited by the whole body of the clergy and the people, monks, nuns, physicians, and I had the benefit of great attention, as all paid me every kind of ministration in the system. The bishop, however, nowhere appeared, but waited for my departure, I know not with what purpose in mind. When then I saw that my disorder had slightly abated, I began to plan forms for my journey, so as to reach a place where I could enjoy a little repose after the calamities of the wake. And while I was thus situated, it was suddenly announced that the Isaurians in countless multitudes were overrunning the district of Caesarea, and had burned a large village and were most violently disposed. The tribune, having heard this, took the soldiers which he had and went out, for they were afraid lest the enemy should make an assault also upon the city. And all were in terror and in an agony of alarm, the very soil of their country being in jeopardy, so that even the old men undertook the defense of the wall. While affairs were in this condition, suddenly toward dawn a rabble of monks rushed up to the house where we were, threatening to set fire to it and to treat us with the utmost violence unless we turned out of it. And neither the fear of the Isaurians nor my own infirmity, which was so grievously afflicting me, nor anything else, made them more reasonable, but they pressed on, animated by such rage that even the proconsular soldiers were terrified. For they kept threatening them with blows and boasted that they had shamefully beaten many of the proconsular soldiers. The soldiers, having heard these things, sought refuge with me and entreated me, saying, even if we are to fall into the hands of the Isaurians, deliver us from these wild beasts. When the governor heard this, he hastened down to the house, intending to succor me, but the monks would not pay any heed to his exhortations, and in fact he was powerless. Perceiving the great straits in which affairs were placed, and not daring to advise me either to go out to certain death, or on the other hand to stay indoors, owing to the excessive fury of these men, he sent to the bishop, beseeching him to grant a few days' rest on account of my infirmity and the impending danger. But even then, nothing was effective. And on the morrow, the monks arrived even fiercer than before. None of the presbyters dared to stand by me, but covered with shame and blushes, for they said these things were done by the instructions of the bishop. They concealed themselves and lay hid, not even responding when I called them. And so he goes on. This is just one of the experiences he had as he was rushed on by the soldiers through that difficult territory, heading towards the Caspian Sea, where he had been told he must stay in exile. But he died along the journey. So 25 years later, the son of the man who was then emperor had his bones brought back and interred with solemn ceremonies in Constantinople and a public service, asking divine forgiveness for the way in which he had been treated. And the Church of Rome, which had broken off all relations with the church in Constantinople because of the way that they had treated Chrysostom, then reestablished relations with it when his bones were brought back and when public apologies were made for the way he had been treated. But still, the situation remained in the Eastern Empire, that the bishop was right under the shadow of the empire and very much subject to the whims of the emperor or of his family. And it's no wonder that in Rome, the bishop felt a very great desire to establish their independence of secular authority. And as we've seen, the, either way, you can get into very serious difficulties, because the heart of man is deceitful and desperately wicked, whether he be a governor or whether he be an ecclesiastical leader, and the best of us make mistakes. And you cannot continue civilization without having a great deal of power in certain areas, but whenever a man gets power, there's a danger of it corrupting him, and it so often does. And so we are very familiar with the troubles and errors that have come into the church through the overweening power claimed by the bishops of Rome, but it's interesting to see how the contrary happened to so great an extent in the East, where the church authorities were so completely under the control of the secular authorities. And now we want to go on to look at another man to whom I'm going to give the Roman numeral N. And this man I am giving a one complete Roman numeral to him instead of putting him in with another, like I did Ambrose and Chrysostom together. Not because he was a better man than Ambrose or Chrysostom. As a man, many would think he was much inferior to either Ambrose or Chrysostom. Not because he was a greater Christian, because Ambrose and Chrysostom certainly deserve to shine as outstanding instances of real, earnest Christians who made their lives count for Christ in every way that they could possibly do so. This man was that we are going to take up now was very much a human being, a man of like passions with ourselves, a man who was devoted to Christ, devoted to Christianity, but who in his personal character, particularly in his attitude toward others, often showed temper and ill feeling and jealousy in ways of which we have no evidence in Ambrose and Chrysostom. But we will devote more time to him than we do to Ambrose and Chrysostom put together, because he was a very great man. And he was a very able man. He was a very earnest Christian, one devoted to the service of the Lord, though a man of great weakness in certain of his characteristics, but a very able man, a very strong man in his abilities, and a man whose you cannot study hardly any faith of exegesis or of biblical study without coming against some real service that he has rendered or some opinion that he has made in relation to it. And therefore, he is a man who is of greater immediate importance to students of theology today by far than either Ambrose or Chrysostom. His name is Jerome, J-E-R-O-M-E. And Jerome is of great importance in two different areas, particularly. He is of great importance as a scholar, because he was the greatest scholar, certainly from the viewpoint simply of scholarship in the sense of wide knowledge, tremendously wide knowledge, great ability to bring things together, to compare them, to show their interrelation in the field of actual scholarship of this type. There was no greater man in the ancient world, perhaps no greater man in the whole history of the Christian church than Jerome. He ranks with Origen in this regard. They are the two great scholars of the ancient world. But Jerome is also of importance, great importance, for another reason, a reason which would make him of greater importance to the Roman Catholic Church than to us Protestants. And that is that he had a very great influence in strengthening the development of monasticism. We have already looked at those who had much to do with starting the trend toward monasticism, which was hardly started. A tiny, small number of hermits at 300, but which by 400 included tens of thousands of monks and hermits. Particularly in the eastern area where the pleasant climate and the large desert, semi-desert areas made sort of hermit life fairly easy to carry on. But Jerome had a good bit to do with the extension of monasticism to the west and with the increase of the idea in people's minds that to be a real Christian, one should live an ascetic life. Now, of course, our Protestant ideal is very different from this. We feel that God desires that we should live normal lives, every portion of which is sanctified and brought into subjection to the mind of Christ. And we feel that we should influence our surroundings and our age in the direction of Christian things. And that is a very great part of what he calls upon us to do. In those days, you had the great mass of the population living in what we would think of as poverty, perhaps rather extreme poverty, but you had a small number of people who were living in what they considered then as very great luxury. Now, what they would think of as luxury, much of it is just ordinary to us. For instance, if one of us has to go 3 days without using soap at all, we begin to feel very uncomfortable. We are accustomed to being able to wash easily and quickly with some soap. But 150 years ago, cheap soap was absolutely unknown. A good soap was a luxury, even 150 years ago. The early settlers to this country had to take ashes and work them over for days or weeks to get lye from them and to develop it into something that was fairly good for washing, but nothing like as good as the soap that we can buy for a few pennies today. And what to us is commonplace was in up to 150 years ago was a real luxury. But back in the days of the Roman Empire, the people with large funds would get very expensive perfumes and very expensive cleansing agents. And to the mass of the people, it seemed the height of luxury, the possibility to indulge in these things. And you had toward the, in this century, you had well-to-do people and leaders in the politically in the empire and their families and their hangers-on who had were able to spend fortunes in jewelry and in perfumes and in foods brought from hundreds of miles away, where the materials brought when the ordinary person had just the cheapest of food. And and there was a great, in the Roman Empire, a great sexual immorality. There was in all periods of the Roman Empire. It was very widespread. And so the Christian, facing a world in which people were struggling for this sort of thing and going to such extremes in it, found a real, rather than spend great amounts of time and effort trying to get these things, they felt they were serving God by abstaining completely from them. And as against the excesses and the immoralities and the wickedness of the Roman world, it was easy to go to the opposite extreme and to completely abandon certain phases of life because of their danger of developing into that which was harmful and wrong. And so this tendency of humanity goes from one extreme to the other has much to do with the development of monasticism during this particular century. In the providence of God, we know God works all things together for good. Sometimes I feel as if they had not developed monasticism, but if instead of that they had actively tried to develop an attitude of spreading the gospel and of reaching people more and more for true Christian principles, that the barbarians could have been really Christianized and the Dark Ages largely eliminated. Whether that could have been done or not, I don't know. But if it was not done, in the providence of God, monasticism made it possible to preserve Christianity through the Dark Ages. It is entirely possible that apart from the existence of monasticism, it's entirely possible that the inroads of the barbarians would have so wiped out all writing, all records, all memory of the great Roman world that we would not even know today that it even existed. We just can't tell. But monasticism was that which kept the scriptures in Europe through the Dark Ages and which kept alive the memory of the great Christian truths, and there certainly among the monks were individuals who were very real Christians in every century of the Dark Ages, even though many of them were not. But we look at that more in detail when we get on to centuries two after the point we're at now. I simply say that in introduction to end Jerome. Jerome is the only one of these great leaders of the church of those days who lived what we would call a really long life. Chrysostom was 60 when he died. Ambrose and Basil were in their middle or late 50s. And there are few instances of these leaders who did not simply wear themselves out at a fairly early age. But Jerome lived to a very great age. If you visit Rome, you go into St. Peter's Church, the largest church in Christendom, the largest ecclesiastical edifice in the world, I guess. There are some very beautiful mosaics in there at different places on the walls, copies of famous pictures, like Guido Reni's the Archangel Michael treading on the devil. Yeah, the original of it is in a church about a mile from St. Peter's, and the lighting is so poor there you can hardly see it. But in St. Peter's it is copied in mosaic, which preserves the colors better than the painting did. It's a very beautiful replica, almost better worth seeing than the original. Another picture you can find somewhere in Rome, you have a very excellent copy of in St. Peter's, and it is Jerome receiving his last communion. And it shows Jerome as an old man, hardly able to move. Shows him lying there on the bed, and shows them very solemn-faced men around handing him the communion. And it reminds us of what a long life of tremendous scholarly activity Jerome had. Activity which he meant to devote entirely to the service of Christ. But so little do we understand our own characteristics that to other people it seemed as if perhaps a fourth of Jerome's activity was devoted to defending his whiteness of his ideas against others and to tearing into the character of those who disagreed with him on various points. And that has hurt his reputation with many students. But his accomplishment is tremendous. So number one is Jerome's birth and early life. He was born of fairly well-to-do, but not wealthy parents. And as a young man, he was given a fair education. He was sent to Rome to develop his studies. And he used as a young man there in Rome during the first half of this century. He was born somewhere between 330 and 340. We don't know the exact date of his birth. But he used to go with other students to the catacombs to see where the Christians had been buried in the time of the great persecution. The catacombs, I believe there's over 400 miles of catacombs. 400 miles of subterranean passages which were dug out in order to make a burial place. That was nothing that originated with the Christians. There also were big Jewish catacombs in Italy. And some of the pagans had catacombs in which they buried their people. That is to say, in those days, it was customary not to make a hole and put a body in, but to make either a cave in the side of a hill, or dig down and then go along, and then on the sides of it have little rooms in which people were buried, or were placed on shelves in these different rooms. And the Christian catacombs, I understand, are 400 miles long. Now, they were completely forgotten shortly after the Dark Ages began. People absolutely forgot they had even existed. And so it was a little after the Reformation when word came out from Rome that these catacombs had been discovered, and the Protestants thought it was a papish plot against Protestantism. But it wasn't at all. They actually had rediscovered what everybody knew about in Jerome's day and was visited by many Christians in his day. But Jerome used to visit these. He was with other students. He was a serious student, a hard worker, probably made more progress in the knowledge of the classics than almost anyone else in of the young men of his time. Very brilliant young man. He went to some extent into the frivolities of and the wicked pleasures of the students of his day, but actually comparatively little. His interests were in quite another direction. But what little he did, he regretted to the end of his days, and often looked back with shame on the excesses of his student days, which probably were very slight compared with the excesses of most students of those days. But as I say, his interest was quite in another direction. But he was a great student of the classics, and he began studying the New Testament very extensively, decided that he would like to learn the original of the Old Testament. And then one night he had a dream. And in this dream he was taken to heaven, And there he saw one sitting on a throne who turned to him and said to him, he said, "You're not a Christian, you are a Ciceronian." He said, what have light and darkness, Christ and Belial, the Psalms and Horace, the Gospels and Virgil, the Apostles and Cicero to do with one another? We cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons at the same time. And he said that in his dream, some spirits came around and began to scourge him, and scourge him so heavily that even the angels interceded for sympathy for his youth. And he himself solemnly vowed never again to take worldly books into his hand. But I don't think he kept up this, because to the end of his days he was quoting from the great classical writings, and in his latter days he did instruct young men in the classics. So I don't think in this regard he went from one extreme to the other, the extreme of the great love of pagan literature to the extreme of utter detestation of it, but he used it moderately and used it for the service of Christ. But he determined that his major interest should be in the things of the Lord and in the Scripture. And so then he went out into the Syrian desert. He left Rome, he went to Antioch, and then he went into the Syrian desert, and there he spent a number of years. He said that in spite of his starved and emaciated body, his fancy tormented him with wild images of Roman banquets and dances of women. Helpless, he cast himself at the feet of Jesus, wet them with tears of repentance, and subdued the resisting flesh by a week of fasting and by the dry study of Hebrew grammar. So his years in the wilderness were not years spent in just lazily sitting around, as you can see. But he made considerable mastery of Hebrew at that time, and there were very few Christians who knew any Hebrew at this time. But he wrote a letter to a friend urging him to undertake this life. He said, even if your mother with flowing hair and rent garments comes to you and begs you to give it up, even though your father should lie on the threshold, yet depart and fly with dry eyes to the standard of the cross. This is the only religion of its kind. The love of God and the fear of hell easily rend the bonds of the household ascendant. The Holy Scripture indeed enjoins obedience to parents, but he who loves them more than Christ loses his soul. O desert where the flowers of Christ are blooming. O solitude where the stones for the new Jerusalem are prepared. O retreat which rejoices in the friendship of God. What doest thou in the world, my brother, with thy soul greater than the world? How long wilt thou remain in the shadow of roofs and in the smoky dungeons of cities? Believe me, I see here more of the light. But he did not stay in the Syrian desert. After a number of years there, he left the desert and he went to various cities and studied under the great leaders there. And he came to Constantinople in 380 when Gregory was preaching those great sermons on the deity of Christ in the Church of the Resurrection, which you remember had so much to do with the end of Arianism. And there he heard this series by Gregory. And he always tried to find the finest Christian teachers or the finest pagan teachers in every city and to attend their lectures and learn what he could from them. And then he came to Rome. We'll call this number one, his birth and early life. Number two, his years in the Syrian desert. Number three, Jerome at Rome, 382 to 385. There's only 3 years he was in Rome, but they were very important years. They were important years for both reasons that we've mentioned in connection with his life. One thing, when it came to study, there was a bishop of Rome at this time named Damasus, D-A-M-A-S-U-S, not an outstanding man. None of the bishops of Rome up till 450 A.D. were outstanding men. But this was a man who was interested in scholarship and interested in learning. And he hired Jerome, or he got Jerome at least, to be his secretary. And he saw Jerome's wide interest and Jerome's scholarly ability, and he said to Jerome, the Latin translation of the Bible which our people are using is not very accurate. He said, I wish that you would prepare us a better translation of the Bible into Latin. And Jerome set to work to prepare a translation, first a revision. He was going to revise the old Latin. Well, the old Latin, the translation which had been made by different people, bits of it at different times, and none of it particularly good translation, but which now was widely read and greatly loved throughout Western Europe. People said if this old Latin was good enough for St. Paul, it certainly ought to be good enough for them. But Jerome set to work to revise it, and people criticized him and reviled him for interfering with the sacred text. But then Jerome saw in many places what a poor translation it was, and he set to work to translate again directly from the Greek of the New Testament. And he also set to work to translate from the Greek of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, which was the Bible of the Christian church at that time, and which was widely used, had been, by the Christian church. But then he saw that the Septuagint had its mistakes and had its errors. It is in many parts an excellent translation, in many parts a very poor translation. And so he gave up his effort to make a new translation of the Septuagint after he had made considerable headway in it, and directed himself to new study of Hebrew in order to get perhaps the finest knowledge of Hebrew that anyone had in his day, and then to make a translation from the Hebrew of the Old Testament. Now this began at Rome with the impulse from Bishop Damon, but it continued through the rest of his life. Through nearly 40 years he was working on it, and it was a very great contribution to make a good translation of the Bible into the common language of the people. Now, the common language of the people all through the East was Greek or Syriac, but through Western Europe, it was Latin. But the Latin language, by this time, had greatly changed from the language of Cicero. The great classics of Cicero and Virgil were the classical Latin. This is 300 years later. Languages are constantly changing. And he didn't try to translate into the language of Cicero, but into the language of the day. Just as the New Testament was not written as people wrote at that time, at the time of Christ, people writing Greek tried to imitate the great Greek writers of 300 or 400 years earlier, and wrote in a style in which none of them taught. But the New Testament is the first good writing in the language of Greek as actually spoken in the time of Christ, instead of imitating the writing of 300 years earlier. And so we call it the Koine, the language of the average spoken person in that day. And the New Testament made it a great literary language. Well, Jerome tried to do that with the language of the Latin people of his day. And so they called it, his translation, the translation for the common people. Now, the words, our English word vulgar originally just meant ordinary or common. But then people began to think of the common people as being people who were unrefined. And so the word vulgar has taken on a different meaning today from what it originally had. But when we speak of the vulgar Latin, we mean the Latin as the people actually taught it 300 or 400 years after Virgil and Cicero. A professor of Latin at the University of Pennsylvania told me a few years ago how there was a book on the vulgar Latin that he was anxious to study, and he looked on the shelves in the university library and couldn't find it there. So he went to the librarian, one of the librarians, and said, can you tell me where I can find this book on the vulgar Latin? Oh, yes, she said. We have that locked away, she said. Vulgar Latin. We have it locked so the average person can't see it. Well, he was quite amused at that because there was nothing unrefined or indelicate about the book. It simply was the Latin as actually spoken by the people 300 or 400 years after Christ. Well, his Bible had to meet with tremendous opposition. He was widely criticized, called all kinds of names for interfering with the text, And he gave them back in full measure what they called it. But he devoted a great part of the rest of his life to making this translation. And it is, it has its flaws, as every translation that ever was made has. But it was a great contribution to make what was really a good translation into Latin of the whole Bible from the original. Now, of course, it's the irony of fate that as the time went on and the Latin language in these different sections developed further, Latin developed into Spanish, Portuguese, French, Romanian, Italian, all the different languages of the areas of the old Roman Empire are developments from Latin, but developed in different directions, so it's hard for them to understand each other. And, of course, in the sections that were not in the Roman Empire, various Germanic languages developed. But the Latin church insisted that the Bible must be read in Jerome's Vulgate. And so a book whose very name means the Bible for the common people, for the last few hundred years it's been insisted that the common people who couldn't understand that language, if they read the Bible at all, must read it that rather than in their own language. But still, to this day, it is called the Vulgate, the Latin translation of Jerome. Now, of course, he didn't do anywhere near all of this while he was in Rome there, but he made the start on it in Rome, and he kept working on it for the rest of his life, and it was a very great contribution to Christian development, and has meant much to people ever since, the Vulgate. At Rome, however, while Jerome was working on his Vulgate, working on various other things, acting as secretary for the Bishop of Rome, also he spent a great deal of time actively promoting monasticism. And he had great success, particularly with the aristocratic women of Rome. That is to say, women from the aristocracy, families that had tremendous amounts of money and were accustomed to living in great luxury. He was able to stir many of these women to give up all of their luxury and turn aside from it all and devote themselves to a life of ascetic abandonment of most of the pleasures of this life and to serious study of the scriptures and trying to learn and to understand the scriptures. And as he did this, some of these women went to extreme in the asceticism to which he led them. There was a young woman, for instance, who went to the point where she ate and drank so little, she became so weakened that she easily fell victim to a sickness and died, and there was a tremendous arousement of hatred against those who had had a part in leading her to this. But her own mother and her own sisters followed Jerome, and there were many, just in these 3 years, many of these Roman women whom he had a great influence upon in this direction. In fact, this one woman, Paula, they call her Saint Paula, P-A-U-L-A, Paula later on went, as Jerome went, to Palestine. And he became head of a monastery and she head of a convent, just a few miles from each other. And they used to meet and study the scriptures together and continued. She spent probably hundreds of thousands of dollars she gave to the various activities that Jerome was interested in. And he had this great influence there. Now, Jerome felt that many of the Christians at Rome were not real Christians at all, in anything but name. In one of his letters, he describes he describes the situation of some of the nominal Christians of Rome and of some of the clergy. He says, "The descendant of the Daci or Maximi is in the grief of early widowhood. With rouged cheeks, she reclines upon a luxurious couch, the gospels bound in purple and gold in her hands. Her room is filled with parasites who entertain the lady with scandal concerning worldly and spiritual things. But she's especially proud of being the patroness of priests. Clergy enter to pay the noble matron a visit, kiss her on the head, and with outstretched hands receive her gracious alms. If they pocket her bounty with perhaps a certain polite bashfulness, the monk who barefoot and in a black and dirty habit is dismissed by the servants on the threshold shows no such hesitation. But see the motley eunuchs are flinging wide open the doors for the deacon, who drives up in a fashionable carriage with such fiery horses that one might suppose him to be the brother of the King of Thrace. His silken garments breathe of perfumed waters. His hair is curled by the barber with the highest skill. And with jeweled fingers foppishly raising his dress, he skips into the palace. His dainty feet, clad by the skill of the shoemaker in shoes of the softest and glossiest morocco leather. Anyone seeing this man would take him for a bridegroom rather than a clergyman. He's everywhere and nowhere to be met with. Nothing happens which he is not the first to know, and there's no gossip of the town which he has not discovered or magnified. His career is, in short, this. He has become a priest in order to have freer access to beautiful women. His way of life is briefly as follows. He rises early, and having planned a visit for the day, sets forth on his wanderings. Where he finds anything beautiful in a house, be it a cushion or a fine cloth, or any kind of furniture, he persistently admires it until it is presented to him. For his sharp tongue is feared by all women. Now, it's easy to see how Jerome became very unpopular with some of the people and some of the clergy of Rome. And they began to try to spread scandal about him, but there was absolutely no ground for that. His contact with these women, he had tremendous influence on them, but it was utterly different from these things which he criticized here. And after Pope Damasus died, Jerome's enemy said that Jerome thought he was the elected bishop in Damasus' place, and that he was angered because he wasn't. I doubt myself there's any truth to that. I don't think his interest lay in that type of work at all, although it might be that he did have some such idea. At any rate, after Pope Damasus died, it wasn't long before Jerome left Rome. And he said that he was so disgusted, he said, at the wickedness and the meanness of the clergy of Rome, that he shook the feet of Rome, the dust of Rome off his feet forever. And he left the city. He went to Palestine. So we call number four Jerome at Bethlehem. Jerome at Bethlehem. He went to Palestine, and Paula went by a different route. She and two of her daughters, they went and met him in Palestine. And there, just a few miles from Bethlehem, he established a monastery where he continued living in great asceticism, but with tremendous scholarly labors. He got a hold of a Jew who was very expert in Hebrew, but who was afraid to come to see him and teach him because of thinking people would be angered at him for doing it, so he came to him at night. And he would come at night, and Jerome would study Hebrew with him. And while with our present-day scientific knowledge of Hebrew, people would say that we have made considerable advances in the knowledge beyond what Jerome knew. He certainly learned Hebrew far better than anyone else, at least any other Christian of his time. And he spent a great deal of his time in many years working on this translation of the Bible there. He was in Bethlehem there from 385 to 420, 35 years. And he was constantly writing articles on various subjects, articles and books and letters, and discussing various exegetical problems, various subjects, entering into all the controversies of the day, and bitterly excoriating those who criticized his translation or his views on almost any matter. And we will have occasional reference in connection with other people to note some of these things in connection with him. But at this point, I want to turn to number five, the Vulgate. Number five, the Vulgate, which I have already discussed at some length the Vulgate. But in connection with the Vulgate, there is a very interesting thing which I discussed in Old Testament introduction. But this is important enough that we should discuss it here also. And that is the fact that in the time of the Reformation, when certain doctrines, such as the doctrine of purgatory, were under discussion, and the Protestants said, where is it in the Bible? People who were defending the view of the Roman Church said, why, here in 1 Maccabees you read how they prayed for the dead. Now, why would they pray for the dead if it wasn't to get them out of purgatory? So there must be a purgatory. So about their only scriptural evidence for purgatory was found in 1 Maccabees. And 1 Maccabees is not in our Protestant Bible. A big argument could have been made that there is no valid evidence in the Maccabees or the other books of the so-called Apocrypha for a belief in purgatory. But the attitude of the Protestants was to get back to the foundation, what is the Bible? And they said, these books, which the Roman Catholics say are part of the Bible, are not. So they called them Apocrypha. The Roman Catholics don't call those books Apocrypha, they call them part of the Old Testament. But there are seven books and parts of two others, which Protestants call Apocrypha. And in some English Bibles, they are printed separately between the Old and New Testament. In most German Bibles, they are printed in small type separately between the Old and New Testament. In the Roman Catholic Bible, they're interspersed among the books of the Old Testament. These seven books, and then additions to two others, which we call the Apocrypha. Well, one of the big arguments for them is that they are in the Vulgate. The Roman Catholic Church has taken the position in recent centuries to a great extent that the Vulgate is the Bible. Jerome's translation is the Bible. They have said that the Greek and the Hebrew, though more original, had been perverted, and that the true Bible was preserved in the Vulgate. It's a rather silly viewpoint, but a very scholarly, highly educated man wrote a book not long ago called The King James Version Defended, in which when you look into it, you find it wasn't the King James Version he was defending, it was the manuscript from which the King James Version was made. The few manuscripts they had before them, which differ in many little points from the earliest Bibles we have, and he claimed that all the early ones were perverted, and these particular late manuscripts were the only ones that preserved the true text. Now, very few Christian scholars hold any such view. We hold that God wants us to look into the evidence and not necessarily believe the oldest is the best, because the reason it's been preserved may be that it was a poor copy and therefore didn't get worn out in use. But yet, in general, the older copies are more apt to preserve the correct text than the later ones. But this attitude they take toward the Vulgate, and so the Vulgate contains the Apocrypha. But it's very interesting that Jerome, who issued the Vulgate, a separate volume, when he'd have a couple of books printed, he would issue them. And the first he said, quite contrary to Ulfilas, who didn't translate Kings at all, he translated Kings first. And so the first he issued of the Old Testament in the Vulgate was the Books of Kings. And in his introduction to them, he specifically pointed out which the books are that belong in the Bible. And he said, everything else is Apocrypha. And he explicitly rejected those books which are not in our Protestant Bible today. He, the translator of the Vulgate, which the Roman Catholic Church today maintains to be the true scripture. Well, you say then, how does it come the Apocrypha is in there, is in the Vulgate? Well, he did not issue one book he called the Vulgate. He issued the book separately. And they were put together later. But some friends who were very fond of the Vulgate implored Jerome to translate the Apocrypha. And finally, Jerome gave in to their importunity to the extent of translating two of the nine books, the book of Judas and Tobit. Judas is a fairly short book. Tobit is quite a long book. And this long book of the Apocrypha, he translated in one day, when with other biblical books, he might take months working over to get them accurate. He translated this in one day. So you see how little he thought it mattered how the Apocrypha were translated. But after he translated Tobit and Judas, he absolutely refused to translate any other of the Apocrypha. And they were translated by others later and put together with his translation to make the volume which is called the Apocrypha. Yes, sir? No, I would say it is impossible to make an accurate translation. I would say that nobody has ever accurately translated anything into from one language into another because words do not exactly correspond. Words are not like points, they're like circles, and they overlap to a certain extent. And therefore, any translation, whatever, is an approximation. But I would say that among translations of books from one language into another, which have ever been made in history, Jerome is probably would rank very high as making a very great step toward accuracy. But of course, there are places, it is very difficult to make a good translation of any book from any language, one to another. Your meanings are different, your forms are different, your methods of expression are different. You cannot be exactly accurate. You leave out some ideas that are in the original, you put in some ideas that weren't in the original, inevitably. And we can point out flaws in it just as we can in our King James Version. But the King James translation into the language of 300 years ago is probably as good a translation as ever has been made of any book into any language, though I can point out some very serious inaccuracies. But they do not affect the fact that it is a very wonderful translation. Well, I doubt if the Vulgate is as excellent a translation as that, but it ranks very high, I would say. But I wouldn't use that word accurate of any translation because it's just impossible to be really absolutely accurate. Yes? The other five. The other five. He translated Tobit and Judas. He did not translate any of the others. The other five, nor the sections of Daniel and of Esther. Those he did not translate. Yes? Yes? No, but in any discussion of purgatory, from any view, you'd find it. But in that, it's a case where some men died in battle, and these men had pagan emblems on them. And the Jews prayed for these men. Well, now, these if these pagan emblems meant they were pagans, they couldn't go to purgatory anyway. So it really is not, it's a pretty far-fetched argument to develop purgatory from that. But I would say if somebody believes the Bible is true and inclines to think there is a purgatory, I would say get them to do this. Take the Bible, take the whole Bible, including the Apocrypha, and go through it and mark every place you find where you think there's a reference to purgatory and see how many you find. And my guess is that the most exhaustive search would produce very, very few places which could be twisted in any way into any suggestion of such a belief. It is something that develops quite apart from any biblical foundation. Yes, well, we'll continue there next year.